The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So Stuart Hazel is the individual that we need to explore. He was born on the 26th of May, 1975. I am the first person to step in and say when somebody has had an awful childhood, we cannot deny that having a really challenging childhood creates cracks in the foundations of an individual's world. It shouldn't be the case. Kids should be born to families who love them and cherish them. It is devastating that children end up in situations that are way less than satisfactory and at times highly abusive. Stuart Hazel was born in a very unhappy situation. He had very little contact with his mother. She was a prostitute, so obviously there was a level of chaos in that world. And his father was in prison. So arguably, not great foundations. I appreciate there will be sex workers who watch this and bring their children up amazingly. There will be ex-offenders who have been to prison and learn their lesson and become really pro-social and role models for their kids. It takes all sorts. What I'm saying is, in his case, it wasn't that way. He didn't have a sex working parent who gave him foundations of support. He didn't have a father who went to prison and learned lessons. So ultimately, he will have suffered from abandonment and attachment issues. And let's be honest, guys, he was massively let down by the very people who are meant to take care of him. His father was actually a repeat offender, and he obviously was an individual who consistently was in and out of prison. Also, Hazel got involved in offending that we'll talk about also later on. So we see this cycle of repetition. Because of this high level of dysfunction, Stuart Hazel ended up in care at a very young age. And again, there'll be people who watch this who have been in care, and care will have been the very difference positively to their lives. They will have gone on to achieve incredible things. However, there is a very large proportion of individuals who go into care, who come out from care criminalized, with very low levels of educational attainment and a whole heap of psychological distress. Because it's really hard being a child in care. Closing that door at the end of every day and knowing that you haven't got people on your side familiarly in your environment, that's an abandoning experience. And Hazel definitely would have encountered those feelings. Also, you won't be surprised to know that Hazel had issues with his mental health, had quite a history of depression. He also used self-harm as a coping strategy, also had numerous suicide attempts. So clearly, this was not a happy human being. We cannot ignore the impact of ending up in care and being let down by his primary caregivers. it will have had huge ramifications, without a doubt. Now, it's suspected that he suffered from something known as unsocialized conduct disorder. So let's talk about unsocialized conduct disorder. Let's look at the symptoms of this particular condition. So you can expect to see within it hyperactivity. That's going to make learning difficult. It's going to also make forming positive relationships at time relatively difficult because of the fact you haven't got a focus, and also people who are hyperactive can be annoying for teachers, so to speak. Also, emotional difficulties such as anxiety, depression, also obsessions. We can expect to see things like aggression, antisocial behaviour patterns, also social isolation from peer groups. So he wouldn't have had necessarily close friends. That's really, really powerfully disorientating for a young person because you want to feel a part of something greater than the individual sum. And he would have struggled with that because of this classification. Hazel really did adopt poor coping mechanisms to actually manifest dealing with his mental health problems, which again, all fits into this particular poor adjustment mental state. So he abused drugs and alcohol, and he actually started drinking at 13. We have so much research now, so much research on how drinking and taking drugs early can impact on the developing brain. I get it. A lot of us out there will have drank as teenagers with the Diamond White or whatever else it was that took your fancy under the bridges or under the motorway bypasses and all the places that kids find themselves getting to no good. But a lot of us can do that without that much of an issue. However, if you have a lot of cracks in your foundation developmentally and then you add drugs and alcohol to it, there can be some pretty serious consequences because you impact on the development of the brain along with all of these other issues that you're facing day to day anyway. And let's be honest, if you have problems and you want them to go away and you drink, then you kind of anaesthetize those feelings. It's temporary. It's a really poor coping strategy. But when you haven't got other coping strategies around you and this just seems to take away the pain, well, understandably, when you're young, that seems like a better scenario than facing what you feel. And if you haven't got the role models and guidance around you, well, that can lead to decisions becoming dependency. So all of what I've just told you means that he would have had big issues that were exacerbated through the fact that he fits this particular classification, but also because he's using alcohol to cope. He was in trouble constantly at school, and his criminal behaviour, it started very young. So basically you see him almost graduating into his father's footsteps. And he actually referred to it, interestingly, as the Hazel curse. Now, psychologically for me, when I hear somebody use that kind of ownership, it bodes really badly for the future. It suggests that the individual sees that there is no escape. It is a given that they will follow a certain type of pattern and behaviour. So the fact that Hazel sees it as a curse, i.e. I am powerless to change this, I have a helplessness here because this is a curse. It's not something I am choosing. It's something that I'm inheriting. It is the natural order within our family. Means that he wouldn't necessarily have confronted the fact that this was individual choice to some degree. Yes, he had been placed in horrible situations. Yes. There is no doubt whatsoever that he had a difficult start, but every single action has a consequence. And what he's doing in saying that there is a curse is he's giving away the opportunity to take the power back and to change and to see himself ultimately as predestined in this negative behavior. And when somebody has that belief that they are predestined to arrive at a certain destination, it can lead to large levels of self-sabotage, a choice to actually get it over with and arrive where they believe ultimately they're going to arrive anyway. That's just something that I potentially wanted to share with you, purely on the basis that it's an interesting connection for me psychologically. His first conviction arrived at 14, so he's very young. Hazel would go on to have over 30 convictions. These included disorderly behaviour in 2001. He was fined in 2002 for racially aggravated common assault. He was done for dealing cocaine. He got a 34-month sentence in 2003. He was given a caution for causing grievous bodily harm. That was in 2006, because basically he just went up to somebody and punched them in the face on the street. He was charged and sentenced for possessing a machete in a public place. Got a 1-year sentence for that in 2010. And know what you're thinking, Emma? Life isn't normal for me unless I'm going out with my machete on the street. I mean, that in itself is highly dangerous behaviour. A machete is something that can absolutely easily kill somebody. And what is anybody doing taking one of those on the street? Simple as. Also, he's done for lots of other various offences. He's included burglary, theft, cannabis possession. So he really did get involved in the system. It's as simple as that. From day one, primarily, really, going into care and onwards, you are in a system, and ultimately it feels like there's a level of institutionalization for Hazel in his early life. At 16, things are bad. They really are. He's living in a homeless shelter in Soho, which is heartbreaking. Also, when he was living at that homeless shelter in Soho, he said he was raped. So that in itself would have been highly traumatic and certainly would have been something that would have caused him psychological distress. Absolutely nobody should be in a scenario where they're meant to be being protected to find themselves in such a heinous type of assault. And without any doubt whatsoever, this kind of an event will have massive repercussions for that human being who's endured it, just trusting the world around them per se. By the way, caveat. I'm not going to keep up this sympathy and empathy and compassion for this guy. Just go with me at this point. We're still dealing with a young adolescent who's been horribly let down. It is reprehensible that at 16 years of age, he is living in a homeless shelter in Soho. It would be terrifying. No matter how streetwise and street smart you are, that is a terrible situation to be in. You do not have the resources socially, psychologically, emotionally, financially. You do not have the wherewithal, consciousness-wise, to cope at 16 in those circumstances. That is society failing right there. And we have to talk about that because the logistics of crime is contributory factors. Could this have been changed? Is there a possibility that if interventions occurred or a catch net was created, could crimes that create catastrophes have been prevented? And that can be difficult, can't it? Because we all want to believe in individual choice. And I get that too. But if we don't look at the systemic issues in our society, particularly and primarily when it comes down to crime and repetition of offences, then we're not doing enough to change the potential outcomes. We have to take responsibility for that as a society, because it takes a village to raise a child, is a saying, and it's a saying for a very, very good reason. Now, around 2007, Hazel meets Natalie Sharp, begins a relationship with her. And Natalie Sharp had a 7-year-old daughter, Tia Christine Sharp. She was born on the 30th of June, 2000. And look, Tia was no...
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.
Ona's a really gorgeous personality. She was bubbly, she was happy, she's a really social girl. She was known to be full of life. There was just something alive and excited about her. When I've heard Natalie and her mother talk about Tia, they miss that energy, that life and soul, that bubbly personality that blessed them daily. And you can feel the loss when they discuss that, because everybody's personality impacts in the world around them on the people that they share that world with. And Tia certainly is one of those individuals. So Natalie had actually been separated from Tia's dad, Stephen Carter, before Tia was even born. And I'll be honest, when she got together with Hazel, it was just one of those relationships that died out very quickly. They were together for like a week or two, so there certainly wasn't any great animosity between the two of them when they broke up relationship-wise. It was just a fleeting, shall we say, connection that petered out incredibly quickly. One could say that was because she had certain levels of taste, but that's not necessarily fair, because the same year, he begins a relationship with Natalie's mother, Tia's grandmother. That was Christine Bicknell. Look, I say that with a little bit of sarcasm, a tiny, tiny bit of weirdness, because I just think it's a little bit off when a guy goes out with one party and then decides that after it's broken down, they're going to date another party, which happens to be a blood relative, in this case, the mother. I find it a little bit weird, but nonetheless, that's potentially just one of those ways that you meet, right? I met my partner because he was going out with my daughter. People do meet in the weirdest of ways. I do get that. So they get on. They really do. And he moves into her home in New Addington, London, just after a week of dating, which I think is way too quickly. I really do. Having noted that, think about the fact that Hazel has had a really disrupted past. He's looking for a foundation of support. He's not had a good housing experience. And all of a sudden, you have a woman who is settled, who does know who she is, who has got a foundation of sanctuary in her home, suddenly extending the opportunity for you to become part of that world. That is going to be incredibly intoxicating and fundamentally something that you are going to be looking for, because my God, when you have abandonment and attachment issues to the level that Hazel would have, you are going to be desperate to feel settled. It is completely natural for human beings to feel that way. Now, that relationship, it was not a flash in the pan. So even though Tia's mother and he had failed very quickly, well, when it came to Christine, that worked effectively. Their relationship lasted 5.5 years. So he was looking for something that made him feel secure. And you have to think to yourself, well, 5.5 years in a kid's life is a long period of time. That meant that as far as Tia was concerned, Hazel was just a constant feature in her life. He was a trusted party. He was someone that featured on a very regular basis in her experience day to day. So as far as Tia was concerned, Hazel was just grandma's partner, like a step-granddad, essentially. And it seems that Tia really did have a good relationship with Hazel. In fact, by all accounts, and there are many, she idolized him. She went out of her way to spend time with him. And even though he wasn't a blood relationship to her, as far as she was concerned, he was a granddad. And he would refer to himself, in fact, as her granddad. And in normal circumstances, that would make my heart sing, because when kids haven't got great relationships with certain caregivers, or they're missing certain caregivers, and then a step caregiver comes in and just blesses them with a relationship, being a role model, offering mentorship, taking them out, having fun, and reminding them that they are loved and cherished, that has such positive impact, particularly because a child knows, you don't need to be part of my life. No, you are choosing to be part of my life. There's not even a blood thing that connects us. And the fact that that individual adult is doing that can speak volumes to that child. It can be restorative when it comes down to fractured relationships elsewhere. So he very much takes this role. She would regularly go around and visit him, and her gran, of course. And they made their home really open to her. They made her aware that she was not just a visitor. She was somebody who was absolutely welcome there 24/7, though they gave her her own bedroom. So again, Tia's experience of her grandma's house is sanctuary. It's a place of safety. It's a place where she fully belongs. And I'll be honest, it's admitted by the family that for Tia, that bedroom in that home with grandma, it acted as a refuge for her, because it was relatively, at times at least, troubled and chaotic in her home with her mother. So that acted as this sanctuary, a place to escape. In 2012, well, she's 12 at this point, so Tia's living with her mother, Natalie, and also her stepfather, David. This is in Mitcham in Surrey. Although she was a really happy girl, one of the things that she'd had to cope with throughout her upbringing was her family's dependency issues, because her mother and David, her stepfather, well, they were both known to social services because they did have problems with drug addiction, and it wasn't low-level dependency. We're talking about use of crack cocaine, and that is clearly something that means that at times parents can take their eye off the ball because they have their own issues. And essentially, I also want to make it clear that in spite of the fact that this would have led to a certain amount of chaos for Tia, and also witnessing things that, look, are fundamentally wrong for children to witness, social services genuinely never considered that Tia was at risk. Yes, they appreciated that she did have a chaotic home life, and actually they investigated her home life in 2011, but they actually concluded there wasn't any need for further assessment. So arguably, whilst the parents in this case had issues, it wasn't transpiring that she was being placed at risk, and it did transpire that she was having her needs met. So even though we can all agree it is not ideal for a child to be in any way close to a scenario that plays out where a child is seeing drugs taken, watching a primary caregiver take drugs, at the end of the day, she was still having her needs met. Social services actually decided the best course of action was to just let Tia's school keep an eye on her. And if there were any concerns that played out, they just needed to report them to social services. Now, sadly, it later transpired that an administrative error actually occurred, and that meant that that particular issue, where they're saying to the school, look, if there's anything that concerns you, get in touch with social services so it can be fast-tracked, it was never communicated to the school. And that meant that she did slip completely under the radar. And again, I'm not saying for one minute that what I'm going to talk about today could have been preventable from Tia's mother and stepfather's side. I'm just saying that when a service is meant to keep a check on a child for good reason, albeit as a conduit with the school. The point is, when that doesn't play out, how do we know what that child is going through? If people aren't told to notice particular issues, then people aren't going to necessarily take it as seriously if that child is more withdrawn or seems more depressed or is saying things that are a little bit alarming. So it is a mistake, clearly, that that administrative error plays out and the school isn't aware that they're meant to be doing that. On Thursday, the 2nd of August, 2012, Tia asks her mum, Natalie, if she can go and stay with her grandmother, Christine, and also Hazel, who's 37 years of age at this point. She wants to go to their home in New Addington over the weekend. Christine was going to be working that night. And this, of course, meant that Stuart Hazel would be the person looking after Tia. Both Christine and Tia's mother, at this point, have a reason to trust Hazel. Simple as that. They believe that he is an individual who has a history of years with this child. We have a child who asks to go and spend time with her grandmother and with her step-grandfather. There is no alarm bells ringing because there is no historical alarm, so to speak. And the logistics of that mean that for Christine and for Natalie, it makes sense that she would be allowed to go and spend time at grandma's place. And they have complete trust in Hazel, because you'll actually see Hazel meeting and walking with Tia at the Croydon train station. They're walking along the platform after getting off a tram at Gravel Hill station. You see them shopping in a branch of the Co-op supermarket. You see them traveling on a T31 bus. And ironically, this is where you'll see Tia alive for the very last time. But you can arguably, in that moment, recognise that Tia does not look afraid. Tia does not look like she's in fear of this human being. In fact, he is a trusted party. And that is something that I think is always the most alarming, hurtful, betraying. The fact that you see a child, a young child, and they just feel completely at ease with this predator and unaware of their capacity for harm. Just going about their business, not knowing that this would be the last time that anyone would see them alive. That evening, her grandma calls Hazel because she's obviously checking in on him, and she actually can hear Tia laughing in the background, so there's nothing that makes her worried for her safety. But the following day, well, we have a problem. There's literally no sign of Tia. At this point, Hazel says, oh, she left that morning. She wanted to go and buy flip-flops in Croydon's Wit Gift Centre. Time passes. At that point, initially, it appeased Christine. Of course, it's not unusual for a young person to go out and shop, but she doesn't come home. This is 100% completely out of character. Look, I will not deny from reports that Tia is an individual who is considered streetwise. So she knows how to deal with life. She knows how to go about her business. She knows what to look out for. You know, she's aware of things like stranger danger. So even though she's streetwise and she knows how to handle herself, there is one thing that she doesn't do, which is to not return home. She's never run away. This is completely out of character. Her family are aware of this, deeply concerned. They love her greatly, so they report her missing straight away to the police. As Hazel is essentially the person who said that he's last seen her, the police speak to him. He tells them exactly the same story. She's left the house. She's gone to buy shoes in Croydon's Wit Gift Centre. However, what they notice is that her mobile phone is still at the property. So that's kind of out of character, isn't it? I mean, is it just me who isn't quite sure whether my own children have symbiotically connected to their own mobile technology, and if I tried to remove it from their hands, I don't believe I'd be able to. I believe it's become part of their body. The idea of young people leaving mobile phones anywhere, aside from in their pocket, bag or hand, is something that very few adults can ever come to terms with because it just doesn't happen. And particularly in these kind of circumstances where it's a young person, that's the way that they communicate if they're safe or otherwise, isn't it? So this isn't normal for a child to leave a mobile phone at home. And the police noticed that it's been last used at 12:42 a.m. on the morning of Friday, the 3rd of August. Now, later that day, Hazel had also called it. So there is a log suggesting that Hazel has called it potentially to see where she is. The police have some suspicions at this point. And it makes sense because it's the last person who's seen somebody that is often the person who had seen them last because they'd done something horrific to that human being. They know that Hazel has been with Tia the previous night. She's disappeared since. So ultimately, at this point, the police basically put Hazel under surveillance whilst the investigation continues. On the 7th of August, 2012, that's 4 days into Tia's disappearance, well, members of a family at this point are just making such emotional pleas. They just want her home. They are desperate. Can you imagine how it would feel to not have seen your child or your grandchild for 4 days? This young person, you know, they're very young. No child who is happy is going.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm going to just run away. It just does not happen. There would have to be a subtext to that reality. And if there's no subtext to that reality, well, we're really concerned because it's out of character and it suggests that they are at risk of harm. And also the first 24 hours are so important in bringing kids home. This is 4 days. So of course they want to go out and speak to the press. They're desperate for her safe return. Her uncle David Sharp is actually wearing a t-shirt with her face on it. And it said, "Tia, please come home. You're not in any trouble." Just trying to get that message across to her, hoping beyond hope that she is out there, that she's elected to disappear, that somehow the family are maybe not aware of the fact that she's unhappy and that she's just hiding out somewhere or she's visited somewhere else. Just come home, it doesn't matter. Whatever is wrong, we can solve. That's the message. On the 9th of August, 2012, Tia's been missing for 1 week. I wonder how you feel at that moment in time. I've worked with families of individuals who've been murdered, and certainly after a few days, the worst fear is that they're not coming home. And on occasion, of course, we see that children and young people do come home, and that's just amazing. But for those individuals at day two or three, there's that feeling in the pit of the stomach that this is sinister, that my child is likely either at risk of terrible harm or has been harmed and is not coming home. So you can imagine the mindset of people in that moment, how desperate they'll feel. Hazel gives an interview for ITV News, just flat out denies any involvement. I had nothing to do with it. You were kind of seen with her the last time though, and then nobody's seen her since. This is true. And she didn't take a mobile phone from the house. This is also true. But she went to buy flip-flops. There's no evidence of that. This is also true. He's clearly setting up that he's just this innocent, loving person, right? He just claims that she's vanished. You know, as young people do, just vanish. Just vanish. So he says that she come downstairs around 10:30 a.m., played games on the console for a little while, then she'd had breakfast, then she'd left the house at 12:10 p.m. whilst he was hoovering. Because obviously, if you're going to do some kind of plea to the press, you're going to want to let them know about what a good little cleaner you are, what a great little step-grandad you are. Look at me, she left whilst I was being a great house husband. What a diligent little cookie I am. Genuinely, psychologically, that's manipulation. No one gives a crap whether you were hoovering or dusting. What we care about is the fact that the child that was in your care has disappeared. Not the fact that you get on with your daily chores. Shouldn't even be figuring in your head. He reckons that at this point he told her to be back at 6 p.m. As we know, Tia's mobile had been left charging in the house, but he's had a bit of time, hasn't he? Had a little bit of time. Why would a kid leave a mobile phone in the house, right? Got to think about a reason for that. So what he says is he told her to leave it on charge, but he hadn't actually meant for her to leave it in the house when she left. So he kind of creates this story where he's again saying, I'm a diligent step-granddad. I wanted her to take her phone, but I wanted her to know that there was enough charge on it and it was just her mistake that she went out without actually taking it with her. So in that interview, he's more concerned, in my understanding of it, to express what a great step-granddad he is and all these things that he does around the house and what a very responsible caregiver he is, giving the individual boundaries to return home, making sure that they have a phone that is fully charged. And it's just been an error on her part that this hasn't played out. Also, in that interview, he basically complains about being under house arrest, essentially, harassment from the media. And he says, loves Tia to bits, described her as being like his own daughter, and said that despite all these accusations that are flying around, he knows deep down in his heart, she left the house that day. I challenge whether he has a heart, but he believes that deep down in his heart, so deep down that it's deeper down than even he knows because he doesn't feel that connection. That's how deep down it is. So deep down that it isn't actually there. It's gone straight through his heart, to his feet, into hell, as far as I'm concerned. Just my own opinion of that situation. He's also constantly saying, I don't know what happened to her. I'm innocent, essentially. And then he stares into the camera and says, Tia, come home, babe. What a narcissistic manipulator. All about him. You know, look, if your kid's gone missing or a relation of you that is a child that you love, the last thing you're that concerned about is whether people think you did it in the first instance, because you know you didn't, you know it's going to come out in the wash. All you care about is getting that child home. If all you're going to do is go on national television and protest your innocence and complain about how everybody's looking at you because you happen to be the last person who was with said child, and you kind of don't make sense as far as having an understanding as to how they've left the house but not been seen, because there's CCTV everywhere. That's why we talked earlier on about how he's seen with her on that last day when she's seen in public. The point is, you are absolutely trying to displace the blame from you elsewhere in this case, he's essentially blaming Tia for leaving and not having a phone. And I would imagine setting up that if she's come to some harm, it certainly wasn't him. Understandably, this is huge news, rightfully so. We have a young girl who's just disappeared. 80 police officers, they join the search for Tia. And you know what? They also start trawling through the CCTV. They go through 800 hours of CCTV footage. Also, they search Christine and Hazel's house. This is on four occasions. That includes two searches on the actual loft space. That's on the 4th and 5th of August 2012. Now, first of all, when they search the loft and the place itself, it's done by an untrained officer, local officers. Then they have a second, more thorough search. That's by two sergeants and two PCs. Hazel actually helps them. He actually goes and gets a chair so that they can get access to the loft, which is mind-blowing when I tell you where they found Tia shortly. But nonetheless, he's a helpful little cookie bringing that chair. Oh, I'll help you. But that's clever. Because if you really want to manipulate a scenario where you seem like you've nothing to hide, you're going to be doing things that seem to help those individuals who are trying to bring the child back that is missing. And if you are guilty as hell, even if you know that they might find something you don't want them to, it's better to look like you had nothing to hide. So going and getting that chair would have been a way of trying to deflect some of that guilt and to cause the officers to primarily believe that he has nothing to hide. And that may mean that they don't search as effectively as they ordinarily would. Now, the third search, well, that was carried out by a specialist team, and that team was comprised of a sergeant and five PCs. They still could not find a trace of Tia. Now, during the fourth search, I know, guys, the fourth search, this was not a castle, by the way. This was not a massive hotel with 150 rooms and loft space that was thousands of meters squared. This was a small place. Then they have a fourth search. I know you guys are thinking, what? Wait a minute. There have been many trained professionals going around a relatively small house. How has a recovery of a body not occurred if there is a body there? Believe me, I'm asking the same questions, particularly when there is this fourth search where they use a specially trained dog that literally signals to the ceiling below the loft. And the officers are like, oh, look, the specially trained dog that's gonna seek out bodies is literally sat under the ceiling of the loft. Maybe we need to throw it out there and search the loft. What do you reckon? Yeah, I don't know. Let's not bother. He got us that chair, didn't he? Literally. Didn't bother searching it on the occasion because, of course, it had already been searched and apparently the dog was too big to safely search the loft space. Makes sense. You know, we could go and search the loft space, being that it seems that this dog that's specially trained seems to think that there's something up there, but you know what? The dog's gonna be too big to go up there. We don't want a dog dropping through the ceiling. It's like, I don't know, get a slim female officer up there, throwing it out there. Back in the old days, they'd have probably just got a teenager off the street, wouldn't they? You seem like a slight teenager. Just come in here and do us a favour. You can't do that now. Risk assessment, health and safety, and obviously the potential of traumatising a child would prevent it. But, you know, back in the 70s, they'd just been like, you, how old? 11? Younger than normal? Get up there. But it's the way that you would expect the police to want to respond because, you know, they're looking for a child. Who knows? A child that could be very badly injured. And yet they feel that because, as far as they're concerned, it's had this brief search, there's no point doing it. Meanwhile, however, Hazel is wearing his innocent persona as loudly and as visibly as is possible. So he joins a local search in the area and he's with officers and residents doing that. So if you happen to be a psychopathic killer, you probably are going to want to follow forensically what's happening. You're going to want to appear like an innocent person, but also enjoy the notoriety of recognizing the impact that you've had. So Hazel may well be involved in the search for Tia to create a guise of innocence, but also because he's getting off on the fact that he knows exactly what's happened to that girl. On the 9th of August, 2012, finally, Tia's grandmother basically notices this really nasty smell in her house, but at this point she just presumes it's cat mess, which I suppose if you've got cats might be a viable belief, but again we're talking about a very odd smell. And it's the day after, on the 10th of August 2012, officers come in the home and they know straight away. They recognize that the smell in the upper rooms of the house is a dead body. They just know it straight away. And this time they use a cadaver dog. And the basis of using one of these animals is that they know how to smell dead bodies. This dog straight away signals to the loft space. And it's at this point they make an absolutely horrifying discovery, because Tia's body is in the loft. It's within just 3 feet of the hatch. I know, how is her body within 3 feet of the hatch? And yet the loft space is meant to have been searched and she's been there the whole time. So I appreciate it was dark up there. I appreciate that she was wrapped in a black bedsheet and black plastic bin bags. So essentially that might have been more difficult to pick up, because obviously lofts are dark, but it would have taken a very rudimentary search to have discovered her right from the get-go. And they can tell when they see this package, essentially, of black bags, that they are new, because there isn't dust all over them. They were dust free. They also notice that there's a big toe sticking through the plastic, and the smell of decomposing flesh had started to permeate throughout the house. They know straight away. They have to obviously positively ID her body, but clearly it's Tia. And they notice that she's actually dressed in her pajamas. What's really awful is, because she's been up there, there'll have been heat, she's wrapped in plastic bags. It means that there'll have been high level of decomposition. That meant that she had to be identified through her dental records and her DNA. They also found other bags stuffed inside another bin bag. One was a Sainsbury's bag, and that actually contained her yellow top and her grey trousers, because of course they couldn't be present in the house. Stuart Hazel has told the police that that's what she left the home in, her yellow top and her grey trousers. And so he's created this photo fit and description of what she was last seen wearing when she disappeared. Another bag contained Tia's damaged pair of glasses. They were wrapped in newspaper. It's unbelievable that this vital evidence had been missed, as officers basically believed the bag was too light to contain anything important. I mean, is it just me? Is it just me that when you're doing a search, you do it forensically in detail? Anything can show you that a crime has played out. Strands of hair, they're not very heavy, but they're bloody indicative, if somebody's gone missing, that a crime could have played out. And other bags each contained a trainer wrapped in newspaper. One contained a t-shirt as well, which had got Tia's blood on it. I mean, there was a huge amount of evidence in that loft space. How the police missed every single one of those bags, aside from her body, is stunning. It really is. It almost makes you feel like they weren't looking for her there, and that created a bias psychologically, so that they didn't even consider that there was a possibility the body was up there. At this point, Hazel obviously knows he's banged to rights, doesn't he? So he goes on the run. However, there's a tip-off that's from a member of the public, and he's arrested the same day at Cannon Hill Common. That's in Morden. The police obviously are devastated that Tia's family have literally been living with her body and that it's taken such a long time to find her. They put it down to human error. Well, it wasn't dog error, was it? Because the dogs on both occasions clearly demonstrated that there was something to be concerned about in the loft. And it's not just human error, it's a massive group of humans' error, isn't it? Who should have known how to search a loft space just diligently when it comes down to a missing child? That delay of not being able to find Tia earlier, it means that it extended the horrific anguish that the family were enduring. Also, even though it's not necessarily more important because family anguish is the primary issue here, but for that anguish to be at least given a sense of justice in the end, you need to be able to create a culpability in the perpetrator, right? If you don't find the body for a period of time, to the point where the body has decomposed, affecting literally the forensic capacity to bring somebody to justice, that is a huge problem, because that completely detrimentally affects the investigation and the potential future prosecution. Vital evidence would have been lost. So that vital evidence doesn't bring closure to some degree for the family. They have to imagine what happened to Tia. Because of the decomposition, Tia's family will never know for sure what actually happened to her. Also, when you think about the amount of wasted man hours that happened there, there was an incredible cost to the investigation. 1 week scouring the local area, trawling through literally hundreds of hours of CCTV. The whole time, Tia's body was literally a few feet from her bedroom in the house that she spent so much time in, feeling like she was safe there. Honestly, it's mind-blowing. It is mind-blowing that the police managed to miss a body in the last place the victim had been seen alive four times. Now, the officers claimed that it was procedural errors that were to blame. They said, at the end of the day, we were looking for somebody who was alive and missing, not a body. I'm not sure that that stands logically. I'm just not sure. Like, so you were told by the perpetrator, it seems, that the victim was alive and well when they'd last been seen. That tends to be the case with people who get murdered. They tend to be alive and well, and then somebody murders them.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Just because somebody says, well, they were just missing, doesn't mean you don't do a thorough search, because horrible things happen to people. But that was the excuse that they used. Now, ultimately, because obviously the offence is so serious that he's been charged with, he's remanded in custody at Belmarsh Prison. Now, at a later court hearing in March 2012, obviously the police have got evidence against Stuart Hazel. It's enormous, the fact that Tia was found in his home where he lived. So it's obvious to everybody that he's guilty. So of course he goes and stands in court and says that he's overwhelmingly guilty for this crime. Said no person with a mindset like Hazel's ever. He's like, I'm not guilty. I am not guilty. Which you all know means that if somebody says that they're not guilty, the family have to face a trial, which is traumatizing beyond belief. And essentially we're talking about the murder of a gorgeous young girl who had her whole life ahead of her. And we're also talking about it being a family perpetrator. And this person just isn't willing at that point to say, yeah, it was my fault. I did that. So he pleads not guilty. And Tia's grandmother, Christine, she actually got arrested on suspicion of murder, which must have been beyond traumatic for her. Because, of course, she absolutely adored Tia. It's as simple as that. She was one of Tia's safe places and safe spaces. And to suddenly be arrested for potentially being part of a murder must have been catastrophic psychologically. And the reality is that you're also aware that that will be in the press and that people who know you will believe that, well, there's no smoke without fire. I mean, there is. Often there's smoke without fire in crime cases. But that's what people do. They group you into a position where they blame you. And that can be just ultimately soul destroying. Meanwhile, 39-year-old Paul Meehan, that was Christine's neighbour. Well, he also gets arrested. He gets arrested on suspicion of assisting an offender. Now, the charges against Christine, they were ultimately dropped. She was not involved in this at all. Her life was devastated when she lost Tia. And the fact that she had to go through the trauma of being accused will be something that she'll live with for the rest of her days, without a doubt. Meehan, well, he actually got sent to prison. He got 5 months in prison because he wasted police time. He actually lied to police. He said that he had seen Tia alive and well the day after she was murdered. On two levels, that is despicable. The human cost level, which is the fact that he lied to Tia's family and made them feel that potentially she was going to come home safe. And secondly, it sent the investigation on a wild goose chase that meant that they weren't looking at Hazel as strongly as they should have been, and they were wasting time going through hundreds of hours of CCTV. So he deserved everything that he got, simple as. Fantasists like that are hugely dangerous to our society. We cannot underestimate their impact because they deflect the opportunity for people to actually look at an investigation in the area that is going to have the most benefit. In this case, it would have been bringing Tia home the day that the offence occurred, or the day after the offence occurred, before her DNA evidence was highly affected because of the decomposition of her body. A makeshift shrine was actually erected near to the property where Tia's body was found. And you know how we are in the UK, and it's like this in the Western world in particular, but people just leave flowers and they left toys. It was just a coming together of a community over something so abhorrent that it was almost impossible to imagine it played out in their local area. Tia's mother and stepdad, well, they left a Hello Kitty doll. They also left a white orchid, and they left a note that said, "We love you very much, always will. Sorry, baby, that this should have happened. I wish I was there to protect you. We know you are safe now, and you are at home with us everywhere we go." Ooh, that's heartbreaking, isn't it? The fact that they say, "We know you are safe now, and you are at home with us everywhere we go." It's true, the indelible link between parent and child, the fact that even when they are no longer present in this world, we are connected to them intimately, intricately, indelibly. It's just the way it is as a loving parent. And those words, I think, resonate with anybody who's got a child. Now, at this time, when this is playing out, there hasn't actually been an official announcement that the body was that of Tia. The autopsy didn't begin until the 10th of August. That's the day the body is found. However, it gets paused later that day. So it stopped. Then we move to the 16th of August, still hasn't been completed. However, even though it hasn't been fully completed, the police are at that point able to confirm that it was Tia's body that they had discovered. Now, as I said, because of the length of time that it's taken to find Tia, the autopsy wasn't able to establish for certain what the cause of death had been. However, let's talk about what they suspected. They believe that the likely death was that she was asphyxiated, possibly smothered. The delays in finding Tia's body and the absence of a definitive cause of death, well, the problem with that is it's going to make the prosecution's job at the trial that much harder. And you don't want that. In clear-cut cases, when we're dealing with child murder, we want the perpetrator literally behind bars forever. Just forever. In my opinion, genuinely, if you murder a child as an adult, forever is how long you need to go down for. And the fact that this, without a doubt, is a sexually motivated crime means that you are a danger per se to any child at any point, whether you are 22 or 72. But this is terrible because we don't want the prosecution to find it difficult to prosecute this horrible murderer. So the investigation continues, and of course, all the police want to do is to build a really strong case against Hazel. And boy, they start doing that because it pretty much becomes very clear when they start investigating him and being diligent around this, that he was not the loving grandfather figure that he purported to be. Quite the opposite, in fact. They realise that, wow, this man, and I use that word and description very loosely, he had developed a really inappropriate sexual interest in Tia. When they searched his mobile phone, they saw that he had extensively viewed pornography, and that pornography featured preteen pubescent girls, basically like Tia. Also, when they did the search, they noted that he had a particular preference for young girls that wore glasses like Tia. He'd even watched incest material online. And you can imagine, he thinks he's a step-grandfather to Tia. She treats him that way. So incest suggests that he gets turned on by the idea of interconnected relations with family members. So even though she's not a blood relationship, their relationship was a very close one. Also, he had images of bestiality. All those images, by the way, that I'm talking about, they were classed as grade one. That is actually the lowest on the scale, but I couldn't care less, because if you are viewing any type of inappropriate pornography with young people, you are a child molester, full stop. I mean, forget the bestiality, that's a whole heap of inappropriate and completely outside the realms of normal, and definitely a paraphilia. But we're talking about the most important part here, which is children that he's viewing. And even though he's got grade one porn at that point, the point is that tends to grow. So it will graduate. And it tells you that his predilection is more than just for viewing this reprehensible material. It's for an actual attraction towards his apparent step-grandchild. Police also disturbingly find pictures and film that he'd literally taken of Tia while she was asleep. Now, look, if you go through my phone, some of the parents out there will be like, that's a bit weird. But others will be like, I totally understand what you've done there. When my kids were little, I used to go into their bedrooms when they were sleeping and take photographs of them asleep in their duvets, snuggled up, because I knew that one day their beautiful baby faces would be ghosts of my past. They grow into young adults and they'll be out of my home for many, many more years than they were in it. So I want to be able to capture those adorable moments where they were just heavily sleeping in the world of Nod, looking serene. And I have video of them doing that as well. It's about me wanting to be able to nostalgically capture the beauty of what it was like to have babes in my home and to be so super protective of them. So on one level, you could say, well, a parent or a grandparent videoing their kid in that respect, that doesn't seem too super weird. But it is super weird when you're not related by blood to this child and this child isn't a baby. We're talking about a young person. And when you add to that the fact that he's got a very odd predilection, an illegal predilection towards minors. So it's really weird as far as I'm concerned that he's videoing her asleep. And his video searches also say that substantiates my point of view, because he liked viewing pornographic images of young girls sleeping. If that isn't enough to show you what a pervert we are dealing with right now, there is no other word for it. He also secretly filmed Tia rubbing a cream into her legs. So a whole heap of voyeurism going on there. And the day before he went ahead and killed Tia, he'd actually taken numerous pictures of her when she was just sat chatting with a school friend at her mother's house. In the weeks before he carried out her murder, it seems like the interest that he had in Tia just intensified. And he had secretly filmed her all the way through July and August. And he took the images, in fact, on two cameras that he kept in the house. And he knew what he was doing was wrong. And I'll tell you why, because he stored the images on memory sticks, which the police actually found during one of the searches of the property. But one of them had been hidden on top of the door frame inside the electricity meter cupboard. That says, guilty as hell. I need to hide this because if you find it, you'll realise I am a reprehensible pervert who needs to be thrown out on the streets straight away because I'm a danger to children. He knew, without doubt, he recognised his perversion and he didn't want to get found out with it. Simple as that. Perhaps, however, the most damning and shocking of all the evidence I've just talked about was another picture that he'd taken. And this was actually a picture of Tia lying naked with her bottom towards the camera, and it had been taken early in the morning of Friday, the 3rd of August, 2012. That was sometime after about 6:30 a.m. That was the day that she disappeared. Now, although you could not actually say definitively that that was Tia, as in you couldn't see her face, they knew it was her because it was her bed in the picture. And that picture showed something very clearly. There was evidence that she'd been sexually assaulted. There was blood on both her genitals and on the bed. The investigation was able to establish, in fact, that there was also blood on the bedding, and the analysis did confirm that it was Tia's blood. Also, on that bedding were traces of Hazel's semen, and also they were able to find a sex toy. It was a dildo. They found that in Hazel's bedside table drawer, and when they analysed it, they confirmed that it had Tia's blood and DNA on it. Before Hazel had actually hidden Tia's body in the loft, it's evident because of that picture that he had redressed her. He'd put her naked body in her pyjamas. But before that, he'd obviously been engaged in sexual molestation of her body. And it's clear that there was sexual activity between Hazel and Tia at some point during the Thursday night, Friday morning. And that's therefore why the police concluded that, as far as they were concerned, this crime had been sexually motivated. Also, it's worth bringing in what experts said about that photograph, because they feel that the photo was taken after he'd murdered her. And the reason for that was that when they looked at the picture of her body, they noticed that her skin had started mottling. So when you look at skin that's mottled after death, what happens is the accumulation of fluid or blood in the lower parts of the body, this is known as hypostasis, well, that occurs after death. Also, they were able to tell that her vagina and her anus were both dilated. Now, on one level, you could say, well, this could be a natural reaction to post-mortem, but on another, it could be due to sexual assault. Now, there were no internal injuries to Tia. There was no tearing or bruising, and there wasn't any semen that they found in her body. But as I've said, the dildo, the fact that her body was dilated in certain areas, the fact that he'd taken those photographs, we can all assume that it makes perfect sense that this is somebody who had murdered her for a sexual motive per se, and sexual assault of some kind took place before or after death. I don't think that's just an opinion. I think it's logic. On the 14th of September, 2012, well, Tia's funeral takes place. It was actually a private family service. They wanted to keep it on the lowdown because understandably they were dealing with mass trauma, and it can be hugely overwhelming when hundreds of people turn up. So it shows that intimately they just wanted to deal with their grief independently of the world viewing them doing that. When it comes to the trial, well, 7th of May 2013, Hazel's trial begins at the Old Bailey. Jurors get shown the photograph that Hazel had taken of Tia's naked body. When that happened, several of the jurors just gasped in horror. Of course, Hazel just denies any responsibility. In fact, this is where he goes with his, "How do I act like a completely innocent person?" He says, "You know what? I didn't kill Tia. No, what happened was she fell down the stairs at her grandmother's." So he claims that Tia had basically fallen down the stairs and tragically died in the house that he shared with her grandmother. And obviously for him, this has been a while of trying to think of an appropriate reason why she ended up dead in his care. And let's just go with that. Let's just look at Stuart Hazel's logic, because I do love a really stupid yet dangerous criminal's logic. Let's just go with this one, Stuart Hazel. So your suggestion is that when you were in care of her, she falls down the stairs and tragically dies, and you sit and think, well, what should I do now? Should I dial 999, call an ambulance, get some help, acknowledge what a tragic situation has played out? Well, I could do that, or I could wrap her body in black bags and a black sheet and store it in the loft. Because that won't make you look guilty, will it? You see, when people like Stuart Hazel believe that they can pull the wool over the eyes of the public, it demonstrates just how narcissistic they are. That if somehow they can convince themselves that this makes sense, they're going to be able to convince others. I mean, no one is going to believe that the lesser of two evils in a scenario where somebody dies tragically is to hide the body. Makes no sense whatsoever. You don't put a body in a loft if it's an accident. Also, bit of a problem for Mr. Hazel there. No evidence of a broken neck or a fractured skull to explain the fall. On day 5, this is of the trial, this is shortly before the prosecution is going to commence its closing arguments. Guess what happens? Literally day 5, when they're about to go off and argue and put together reasons why he should be incarcerated, he decides now is a good time to say, "I did it." Yeah. Now he thinks is a good point to be like, "Well, I've just cost an inordinate amount of money, both initially by lying about the fact that I murdered this poor child, but now I've made you pay for an incredibly expensive court case." But before you get to say guilty, throw everything at them, throw everything at Mr. Hazel, I'm like, I've kind of heard the evidence and it is quite compelling, and it seems that the prosecution have done a really good job, and it does seem that I'm definitely going to get found guilty, so I may as well just try to seem compliant and remorseful by acknowledging that I was the person who killed her. Of course, we all know why he's doing this. He's doing this because he thinks it may reduce his sentence. So now he's said that he has actually killed poor Tia, this innocent, gorgeous girl who just should be living her life fully and being loved by the people who adored her. Because he's taken that from her, Understandably, he is facing the mandatory life sentence for murder. So in sentencing him, Mr. Justice Nicol, he needs to establish the minimum term that would be required for Hazel to actually serve before he gets eligible for parole. Now, when it comes down to those all-important aggravating factors in this case, wow. First of all, Tia's young age, she was 12. 12 years of age. Also, massive breach of trust. That was her step-grandfather. She'd spent 5.5 years of her life building a relationship with him, trusting him. She viewed him as a loving adult. She trusted him to look after her, and instead, he sexually assaulted her, violated her, and then killed her. Had the judge have actually concluded that Hazel's motivation for the murder had been sexual, well, he would undoubtedly have been given a whole life term. I genuinely think that he deserves a whole life term, full stop. But the judge felt like, even though it was, as far as he was concerned, likely that the reason that Hazel had killed Tia was for sexual purposes, he couldn't be 100% certain, basically, because he said that, yeah, sexual activity had clearly taken place between Hazel and Tia, because the photograph of Tia's naked body, the DNA evidence that substantiated that point. But when it came down to the photo...
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Where the suspicion was that Tia was dead, the fact that her phone hadn't been used for hours, plus the mottling of the skin, as I've said, says that she probably was likely dead. The problem the judge had was it may not absolutely have been the case that she was. She could have been asleep. And there was another argument saying the mottling that we all think was because she was dead at the time, but there was another potential reason, and that was that it could have been caused by light or natural skin coloration. Also, there was this possibility that Hazel had sexually assaulted Tia and then basically killed her out of shame, fear, panic. So it wasn't that he'd gone out of his way to lustfully murder this girl. It wasn't absolute that there was a premeditated desire to kill her. Now, nevertheless, whilst sexual motivation for the murder couldn't be absolutely proved, what we can say, it was a killing that had involved a sexual assault at some point not long before death. Now, another aggravating factor was the fact that he took a degrading photograph of her. Also, come on, he'd hidden Tia's body, and hiding of that body meant that it delayed the opportunity for her family to know what had happened. It caused massive anguish to the family. Also, wow, an aggravating factor is that he just went on national TV denying his involvement, basically telling the world he was innocent and completely lying about her whereabouts. Also, another aggravating factor, massive list of previous convictions. They are highly aggravating. Don't get me wrong, those previous convictions, it was accepted that none had been for really serious violence, but nonetheless, it evidences that this man was not pro-social. When it comes down to mitigation, well, you won't be surprised that he took into account as a judge Hazel's really quite troubled childhood, what we talked about earlier on. Plus, they said that they couldn't prove that the actual murder had been premeditated. So it wasn't necessarily that he'd been planning this for a long period of time. However, even though they were mitigating factors, the guilty plea that he gave at the last minute, well, that didn't really carry any weight. It had become available at the 11th hour. And it also meant that Tia's family had basically endured 4 days of the trial. Remember as well, guys, that Tia's family are watching this play out, and his partner had been Tia's grandmother. Imagine where she is mentally. Her whole world has just absolutely disintegrated, and he is happy to put her through it. And he knows that she was charged initially on suspicion of being involved with the murder. I mean, how much more pain does he want to bestow on these individuals? That family had to sit through graphic details of Tia's murder. That was all avoidable if he just said, I'm banged to rights, I absolutely did it. And to show some kind of responsibility, some kind of accountability. And whilst I don't necessarily think that people like Hazel really understand remorse, it would have at least identified that he realised that he had done something wrong and he deserved to be punished. Hazel was ultimately sentenced to a minimum of 38 years. Now that means he's going to be 75 when he becomes eligible for parole. That's if the parole board ever deem that he's no longer a threat to the public. Which, shall we have a vote? Shall we take a vote on whether Stuart Hazel, child murderer, molester, should ever walk the streets again? By the way, in the comments, feel free to say what you think about him, because I'm going to say no. I'm going to say let him rot in jail before rotting in hell, a whole heap of hell for eternity. The judge stated she was a sparky girl. She was full of life, but you took that life from her. All that lay ahead of her, a career, loves, the family of her own, will now never be. And the loss of her has been devastating for her mother, her father, and all of her relatives and her friends. The tragedy of their loss and her death is because of your act in murdering Tia Sharp. You are responsible. I think it's really nice when a judge does a really strong summing up, letting them know about the ripple effect and impact on all the people that Tia loved and all the people she should have known and all the kids she should have had and all the jobs she should have succeeded in, all wiped out by that man's sexual selfishness and dark predilections. Croydon Council, they stated that the house where Tia's body was found, along with two of the houses either side, would be knocked down. They wanted to level it. And I think that is the correct course of action, because nobody should live in a home where a child has met her death in such an untimely and despicable manner. Following Tia's tragic death, well, there's been a big debate about the role that pornography had played in Hazel's actions. There was no doubt whatsoever when they explored his digital footprint that he had a considerable number, collection-wise, of child porn. And due to the digital revolution, look, child abuse images have massively increased, massively. In 1995, Greater Manchester Police were able to seize 12 indecent images of children. 12 indecent images too many. Let's be aware of that. Absolutely. Not underplaying it. But 12 in 1995. 4 years later, in 1999, that number had risen to 41,000. Nowadays, the number of unique abuse images online, unique, is in the millions. That represents tens of thousands of victims. Interestingly, a US study actually found that in both 2000 and 2006, one in six cases that involved the possession of child porn detected offenders who had actually committed direct physical crimes towards children, so they'd physically molested kids. But they haven't proven a causal link between the viewing of child pornography and the actual commission of child abuse against children. Although you guys know that my view is, if you are viewing material of sexually explicit nature regarding children, you are a child molester. You don't need to physically abuse a child to be a child molester. You just need to get off viewing the horrific abuse that they suffer. That's material is created because people sit behind their screens and enjoy viewing it. That makes you an abuser. It makes you a child molester. But they haven't been able to prove that that will then mean that you leave said screen and actually go out and abuse a child. Logic would suggest there's a strong possibility though, wouldn't it? One thing that has been interesting to explore is the fact that whilst child porn has significantly increased, according to data and research, rates of child sexual abuse seem to have fallen between 1990 and 2007. And this is actually substantiated in the US in particular, where abuse cases have dropped by 53%. I just think that that means that a lot of people aren't taken very seriously when children come forward and talk about sexual abuse, or predators have just got really good at selecting the most vulnerable kids so that they don't report it. But who am I to throw out such what I would consider massively logical common sense suggestions? Anyway, that's what the data says. It's saying that in spite of the fact that child abuse continues to be a problem, it's not necessarily a consequence of today's more sexually liberal society, because the data doesn't support that. The argument is, yeah, it has always existed. And according to that data, one could argue, well, even more so it existed in the past. Sorry. I know that I'm meant to bring research in and be like, the research and data tells us this. It's definitely a fact. But it just does not make sense. Oh, so there's millions and millions more photographs of kids, all different kids, but we're pretending that child abuse has dropped. It really drives me mad when research doesn't evidence clear logic. So in my opinion, it could just be, like I said, that they attack very vulnerable kids, or that they get involved in children who are being sex trafficked, who don't even have a voice, or that the mass sexual abuse of kids has moved to poorer areas in the world. Think about in the UK, Gary Glitter, what a pervert, you know, going to Southeast Asia to abuse children, the Philippines, etc. These are places where paedophiles can get away with molesting children and very little will ever be said or done about it. Now, in Hazel's case, I think we can all agree that we can link some of his offending behaviour to his highly dysfunctional, highly abusive childhood. And what is quite surprising about this case, and I have covered a couple of others, like Tia Rigg, for example, where her uncle horrifically raped and murdered her. There was no warning signs as far as the family were concerned about the uncle's behavior, and suddenly he carries out that horrific murder. Similarly, in this case, Hazel didn't necessarily give off any warning signs to family members that he was such a danger. Now, arguably we can say, well, he was clearly an accomplished liar. You know, this is a man who survived some pretty inhospitable experiences by manipulating the system, getting involved in crime, taking things that weren't his. So he is somebody who's quite happy to involve himself in criminal behavior, and often that involves lying. Now, a man who actually let a window cleaning round to Hazel later stated to him that he used to talk about a father who died of a heart attack. And he said that when Hazel would talk to him about his father who died of this heart attack, he'd basically break down crying about it. Only problem was, his father was still alive. Also, he was known to kind of change versions of events at will. And it really didn't bother whether these points that he was making were very important or weren't important at all. He just liked lying. So it could be that there is a compulsive liar within him. Also, what makes him scary is that Hazel was not on the police radar. He hadn't committed a serious violent or sexual offence in his history that had at least been found out. And it feels like his growing interest in child porn and his obsession that he had with Tia had been very secret. He wasn't involved in big communities talking about wanting to abuse her. He wasn't being radicalized by others online with that unhealthy interest. It was like he had fixated on her, and that fixation had grown and grown and grown to a point where, somewhat out of the blue, she was suddenly brutally sexually assaulted and murdered. You know, he'd watched Tia grow from a young girl, a little girl. And it feels like there is, in my opinion, a tipping point when she starts to approach puberty, when she starts to reach that point that suddenly he loses that childlike connection with her and he starts to see her in a very sexual way. It's there that his interest in her seems to increase. And what really gets me about this case, like in so many cases, is that that place where she was murdered, you know, her grandmother's home, it was just a place of sanctuary. It was a place of refuge. It's where she went at times to avoid the chaos. It's where she went to play computer games, have fun. She had her own bedroom there. At no point did she realize that that was ultimately a place of danger, of horror, the setting for her own murder. That's what makes this case just so diabolical, that safe haven became a place of torture and death for that little girl. This has been a really tragic case, and I wanted to cover it, as I said, because it was one that was close to my heart from my early years presenting crime shows. The reason that it really stays with me is because this was a trusted individual that this child had no reason not to trust. And somehow he gets to carry on living, eating, breathing, being looked after by our taxes after she had her whole future decimated by his actions. And the impact on her family has just been utterly tragic. I don't think he will ever be safe to walk the streets again, and I would feel much happier knowing that he will never get out of prison. I also leave you with that question. Do you really think that child abuse rates have been dropping? Or do you think that we're not doing our job enough to locate, identify, and bring to justice these monsters, molesters that live amongst us? Look, it could be that we're doing an incredible job on educating our young people to the point where when anybody comes close to molesting them, they know who to talk to and turn to prevent these situations escalating. But I highly doubt it. I just think that paedophiles are either getting better at who they molest, or they are going to countries where children are molested without any kind of recourse. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.